A poem by Sherry Hustler, Instructions. Give up the world, give up self, finally give up God. Find God in rhododendrons and rocks, passerbys, your cat. Pair your beliefs, your absolutes. Make it simple, make it clean. No carry-on luggage allowed. Examine all you have with a loving and critical eye, then throw away some more. Repeat, repeat. Keep this and only this, what your heart beats loudly for, what feels heavy and full in your gut. There will only be one or two things you will keep, and they will fit lightly in your pocket. Instructions by Sherry Hostetler. All right, so tonight we continue with our explorations of the paramis, the 10 perfections. So this month we'll be focusing on energy. So energy is this next parami. And it's the energy specifically around energy for practice, the willingness to get on the cushion, to be willing to study, to be willing to do inquiry, to really look more and more deeply at the nature of things, to understand our own assumptions of the world, the way we create separation, the way we create delusion, the way we create harm in our lives, and to also see the freedom from that. This is the energy of this parami. Now, wise effort, there's some crossover, some relationship between wise effort and this parami of energy that we'll explore a little bit tonight also. Now, we can look at the paramis as these 10 perfections as a linked process. We can also look at them each individually. They both have their utility. So first, looking from this linked quality. So we started this series off back in February, noticing or exploring the parami of dana, of generosity, right? So we talk about dana often in terms of support for the organizations and teachers, but it's a much bigger concept of how do we actually relate to the world from a place of generosity. We start to relate from that way. We start to shift from our sense of isolation, of separation, to start to realize the interconnection. It's really hard to maintain that when we're acting in a generous way. Then we move into the next parami of sila, of ethics, morality, of virtue, different ways of translating this. And this is also connecting with our hearts, to realizing that our actions can cause harm, and to develop this deep commitment not to cause harm in all the different ways and different nuances of our world and of our actions. And then from these two, so we learn how to not be so separate, so ego-driven, so sense of really locked in our greed and our fear, to start to open our hearts through generosity, through non-harm. And then renunciation is the next parami, which needs really flows beautifully from that, because we start to wake up and see, wow, this action is not really coming from a generous place. This action is coming from a place of harm. Then we start to renounce those. We start to drop the energy from those. We don't keep feeding those qualities. And these three create this beautiful soil for wisdom to start to grow, to start to cultivate. Because we start to quiet our systems, we quiet our reactions, we start to quiet our reactivity and the ways that we see, you know, keep that inner turmoil going. This is one of beautiful aspects. As we start to feel connected to people, we start to act from a generous place, a place of non-harm, there's a lot less internal chatter. There's a lot less internal noise that starts to come. Because we're at peace, because we know our actions are aligned with connection, with care. And from that quality of settledness, we start to perceive things how they are. Wisdom starts to grow. We start to understand the nature of our own minds, the natures of our hearts. We start to understand the difference of something that's impermanent to really see that, to rejoice in the impermanence. We start to understand really the substantial nature of things from dukkha. We also start to understand this nature of self isn't as strong, as intact as we often think it is. We start to realize that as I look more closely inside, there's actually some emptiness, not in a sense of voidness, but actually a deep quality of interconnection. So wisdom starts to arise. So we see how the paramis start to build upon each other. So from that place of wisdom, energy arises. Energy arises to understand more deeply that wisdom, to energy to bring back even more into our behavior, our ethics, into our generosity. So how does this happen? How does this start to work this way? How does wisdom move into this parami of energy? You could say it almost boils down to two main sides of it. This is what the Buddha famously said that he taught one thing, dukkha and the end of dukkha. I know those are two things, but you know, the kind of the basic thing that he would explore in his teachings was, where is the nature of suffering? How does that arise? Not in an abstract way, but actually in the choices that we make, in the ways that we misperceive, the ways of habits of mind. How does that dukkha arise? And equally importantly is understanding the release of that dukkha, the release of that contraction of heart, relaxing into the sense of inner connection. Finding peace, freedom, contentment, happiness that's outside of conditions, that's outside of the normal conditional way that we relate to life and our own happiness. There's a famous line in one of the suttas, or a few of the suttas, where the Buddha's describing working with someone who doesn't feel like they have much energy. And he said, well, how much energy would he have if your hair was on fire to put out that fire? You know, the sense of urgency, the sense of energy will be right there. There would be no question. You'd be looking for the nearest water right away. And so that's part of the purpose of our meditation practice, is to see that our hair is on fire, that there is suffering. Like the fire sutta, where the Buddha is saying the whole world is on fire of greed and hatred and delusion. We just don't realize that. We don't notice it. And that basic confusion, that's what keeps the suffering perpetuating, keeps that cycle going and going. And we start to see that, we start to observe it. Sometimes it's an intellectual seeing. Sometimes the more powerful ones are actually the ones in our hearts. And it's like ourselves, we actually see things in a different way, in a more full way. And then things just start to fall away. We start to release things. We don't keep putting the fire back on our hair. Right? So if that's the stick, then the carrot is this other side that brings energy forth. Right? So there's an energy of seeing what causes suffering and releasing it. And there's the other energy that comes from that yearning of the heart, that this aspiration to awaken, to deepen in our practice, to learn how to really live a life that we would feel, you know, proud about. And, you know, this life I've been living is based in connection. It's based in non-harm. It's based in compassion. And also starting to sense, what is it like beyond this isolation of self? We start to open to the wonder of interconnection, of non-self, the taste of awakening, of enlightenment. And so sometimes this is a very, very simple, very concrete in our lives. We notice I'm just relating to my loved ones in a different way. There's a way that I'm more patient, more kind, you know, more considerate. Maybe I start to care for myself in a different way. Meeting a stranger, that there's a different quality that comes forth that's not based in contraction, not based in separation. Sometimes it's that glimpse or taste or this prolonged, you know, opening into something that's so vast and so so still, but yet so interconnected. You feel like sense of you has fallen away. So both of these aspects of our practice brings forth energy. Energy to deepen more. Energy to not cause harm. Energy to live a life that's ethical. And these are factors of wisdom. So wisdom and energy are so intertwined. And they're actually supported by all the other paramis. And energy also goes back into the paramis too. So it's kind of this constant feedback loop. That the more energy we have, the more we bring that to how we are in a generous life. How do we are in an ethical life? How do we bring energy into renunciation? So wisdom gives us the energy to practice. And it gives us the energy to, okay, I want to really show up. I want to sit every day, go on retreats, or whatever form your practice takes. Maybe your form of practice is sutta study. Maybe it's in relationship. Maybe it's of service. Maybe that's how your practice shows up. So wisdom gives us the energy to practice, but wisdom also safeguards energy and effort to keep them balanced, to keep them appropriate, to keep them actually helpful. So we can think of energy or effort is almost like the energy or the engine of a car. And the energy is like the gasoline that we put in to run that engine. Allows the engine to run. Because energy and efforting, there can be distortions around that too that can show up in our practice. And that's some of the struggles that we have is when those get out of balance. Because energy allows us to apply effort, right? But sometimes that effort can be wise or unwise. Right? So effort and energy, they start to really come together. Because if we don't have wisdom in our effort, or if we don't have wisdom with our effort, then that energy starts to really become a little distorted, starts to go into more striving, trying to get to be something that we're not. I want to get somewhere else, trying to obtain something, trying to become someone who is enlightened, you know, whatever sense our minds project on that, an extraordinary person. I want to be like that. Now, some of this is, I think, inevitable, that we start practice and we kind of, most of us, come to practice from a place of trying to work with suffering, to try to get through that suffering that we're experiencing. You know, something is just not working well in our lives. In my own practice, I started back in 96. Last century, that sounds old. But I was, you know, going through, as many of you know, through a breakup of a relationship. And, you know, those breakups can be very painful. You know, your whole life is kind of oriented toward it, and then that changes. And I started to hear the words of the Dharma. And that really caught my ears. Like, well, there's maybe some of the suffering I'm having, I'm experiencing, isn't just the situation, it's the way I'm relating to it. It's the way I'm holding it. And that is actually a very empowering thing to know. It empowers us to know that, okay, the suffering isn't just I'm a victim to it. It actually means I have some capacity to meet it, to learn to grow, to work with it. Actually change my attitude, change the way I relate, to see the underlying assumptions. And so we start off practice often to try to get over ourselves, right? We're trying to get this mind who's just always thinking, the monkey mind, this tyrant that's always telling us how we should think and do and do something better, do something, you know, a little differently or a lot differently. That constant inner narrative. We know it's such a burden and we want to get over that. We want to quiet it. We realize I'm really reactive. I cause a lot of harm in my life, so I want to be a better person. So many of us, that's how we start our practice, is to try to get over ourselves, to become better. Right? So this is a valid reason to practice. And luckily, wisdom of the practice itself shows us, we start to see the fallacy of that. We start to see that, okay, the reason I started practice, it got me going, but I actually need to rechange my assumptions. That's probably the biggest easiest way to say it, is that the assumptions which we hold as true when we start practice don't stay true. They start to transform. And then wisdom starts to change with that, energy starts to change and grow with that also. Now, in many ways, as our practice matures and deepens over the years of practice, our effort should become less and less, how much effort we put into it. And yet, the effort becomes more accurate. It becomes more specific about where exactly is the problem. Where's the struggle? Where's the delusion? Where's the not seeing? Right? It starts to become more and more fine-tuned. So just like anyone who's really a master, an expert at something like skiing, they can just make fine little tunes, or turn shifts in their weight and make huge changes in how they're gliding through the snow. And so why is effort, so again, going to effort and energy and kind of looking how they intertwine, why is effort has this quality of discernment, a quality of wisdom kind of baked into it. That's why it's called the wise effort from the Four Noble Truths. So that's the main effort or main discernment is understanding what causes suffering and what causes the release of that suffering. And then we start to, the effort is just, okay, I'm going to put less energy into what causes suffering and more energy into what releases that suffering. It's, in some ways, it's as simple as that. There are more and more nuances to that. And that wise effort is fueled by our energy. And the energy just keeps feeding that in. So it becomes more and more accurate. We start to know our patterns. We start to know that conditioning. We start to see it not so personal. And that not seeing it so personal, then it starts to transform. Because we start to practice, before we practice, the mind says something. We think, okay, that's who I am. That's what I am. And we start to see through that more and more. Sometimes I get interested in the study of mastery. And you've probably heard that there's a statistic that if you do something for 10,000 hours at the end of that, or if you do it for 10 years at the end of that, there'd be a level of mastery that comes from that. And that's certainly true with practice, meditation practice. But it's not just any kind of effort. It's not just that putting the hours in. It's the quality of that. And that's what I mean by the energy and wise effort has that quality of discernment, really being more accurate of how, what's causing suffering right now in this argument with my spouse? How's suffering showing up in the way I'm relating to the traffic, relating to the weather, relating to whatever it might be? How is that actually showing up? Very specifically in my own mind, not abstractly, not in a quality of like, oh, this is a big philosophy. Let me actually see that contraction. Let me see the release of that. When you're seeing that, there's lots of energy because you realize I can actually have some way of interfacing, of actually having some empowerment around this. So those 10,000 hours, it's actually 10,000 hours of constantly moving kind of beyond people's level of competency, that they're stretching that envelope. They're working out beyond what they're comfortable with. Like one of my hobbies is I like to play chess. So I started playing chess in elementary school. And I think if you looked at those, how many hours and years I've practiced, because I haven't practiced very well. I just kind of play, right? And I make the same mistakes over and over again. So there's not that level. I'm not really on a path of mastery with that. Well, some other things in my life, I have been more on that path of mastery, of being able to work that edge to see, okay, where am I contracted? And this really ties into what we'll talk about in a little bit, is when we don't have our energy for practice, is that often confronts us. Because we like to be comfortable, right? We like to be told, you're doing this great. You don't have to change anything. You're perfect, right? We love to hear that. But if we're always told that, we would never really grow. We wouldn't really grow in anything we tried to do. But learning how how can I keep always be learning, always be growing? This brings this quality of mastery into it, which for me, I think is a big part of this energy. Because energy has this sustained quality. It's like this quality of endurance, this quality of perseverance, this willingness to keep on going. And energy also has this full-heartedness to it, this willingness to really bring our full commitment to this. So now for the last bit of this talk, I'd like to explore, what do we do when we don't have energy? Don't have energy for practice. Just maybe that's not relevant for anyone. Anyone ever have any trouble practicing every day? You're like, oh, maybe I'll do something else. Something else is a little bit more entertaining and more exciting. Yeah. It's very common. You know, we don't feel motivated. We don't feel that energy to practice. I think back when you first started to practice, it was like new. It was like, it was interesting. It's like, wow, I just want to keep doing this. Maybe it wasn't like that for you, but a lot of times it is like that. There's this energy that kind of carries us forth. So there's three reasons I want to explore. These are not all the reasons, but these are maybe three that might resonate, and certainly ones I've worked with. The first one is that there's struggle that arises. There's difficulty arising in our practice. And it becomes too hard. We just don't want to keep doing it. We get discouraged. We get confused. We're just, you know, it feels like it's making things worse. In the intro class that I teach, often around like the third or fourth week, people start to, you know, realize, well, maybe, you know, this isn't working because I'm actually feel like I'm more angry or more upset than I was when I started. And really what's happening, they're actually realizing what's actually there. You know, instead of being so distracted and disconnected from themselves, they're actually becoming more connected. They're actually seeing what their mind is actually like. So if you didn't realize that was going on, you'd be very discouraged. You'd be like, wow, I think I'm going to go back to something else, something more entertaining. So sometimes the difficulty in practice has to do with the techniques, you know, the way we're, the kind of actual mechanics of how we're practicing. And a lot of my time as a teacher, I'm helping students kind of navigate this. Because type in, you know, meditation on the internet, you know, how many different instructions are you going to have access to? And how many of those are, you know, mutually exclusive or contradictory to each other? You know, always focus on the breath. No, never focus on the breath. Always focus on this. There's going to be it's going to be very confusing. And sometimes we try to make a technique fit us when maybe it's better to shift techniques. So this is a really interesting kind of line for us to navigate. Because historically, in most of, you know, Buddhism and Dharma practice, you were lucky. So we're looking at the 2,600 years, you know, that perspective. You were lucky if you found one teacher to listen to. If you just happen to have a teacher that you could actually have contact with and, you know, meet and hear the teachings and have some guidance. And you just try to follow that teacher. Nowadays, you know, literally with our devices and our phones and the internet, we can have access to hundreds and hundreds of teachers and hundreds of different kinds of instructions. And so the plus side of having one that we stick with is that we learn how to really mind the depths of it, to go into a deep way. And we also learn how to keep working with the struggles that come up, right? The downside is if that one way doesn't fit your temperament or your conditioning, you're kind of stuck. You know, you're out of luck with that. Downside of this day and age is that we kind of get discouraged and we switch to something else. It's like, okay, this, like we're riding like a merry-go-round. Okay, I don't like this horse. I'm going to jump on this horse. Okay, that one I don't like. And we don't realize that we're actually using that restlessness and aversion in our very practice. So what I tend to suggest is find one practice, one kind of tradition, you know, one kind of framework that kind of resonates with you, that feels like it's leading onward, it's helping you understand yourself in a deeper way. Is there something you want to learn from it? And stick with that for a while till there's some grounding in it. And then you can start to open to other practices and they make more sense. But sometimes it's a simple matter of, you know, how do you work with the thinking mind? You know, often when I talk to students, I try to sense, where is the struggle? And where is the assumptions? What are they assuming is how things should be? Whether their own mind, in their own technique, you know, and where the struggle is, and trying to highlight that and see if there's some way to change it. Sometimes it's a simple shift of attitude. You get lost in thought. Instead of judging yourself for being lost in thought, say, wow, I've actually woken up from being asleep. That's great. Good job. And then I come back to my breath, come back to my body. That's very different than saying, God, I just got lost again. This is a failure. I'm never going to be any good at this meditation stuff. You know, did it ever run through your mind? You know, I'm failing at this like I've failed at all these other things in my life. Where does your energy go? Goes out the window. You start to encourage yourself, the energy comes back up. You can see how energy and, you know, sometimes we think we don't have the time for practice, but I think it's often we mean we don't have the energy. So this is these things are really about energy of practice. Sometimes the technique that you're trying to apply just isn't the right fit for, you know, you right now. Then we may need to shift that. And unfortunately, we can find teachers that say, this is the way you have to practice, right? And sometimes that's really not the right way for you to practice. Trauma is a great example of this, that it took, as a community of teachers and practitioners, it took us a while to understand that sometimes asking someone who has unresolved trauma in their system to go and just be quiet and open to your breath and open to your body, sometimes that's like putting gasoline on a fire. It's like it opens up the trauma. It actually makes it more intense. Sometimes it's like flashbacks, those kind of energies. Sometimes it's more of the sense of collapsing, of lack of energy, of more of the disassociation side of trauma. So learning to understand that, there's nothing wrong with your system. You just needs to be taken care of. Learning to work with your bodies too, the difficulties. When I first started to practice, I had this idea, you know, again from the teacher I was listening to, that I should sit still and not move at all, right? So that's kind of basic instructions. But I took that really literally, and being, you know, a kind of a tight fascia, tight muscles, there's just a lot of discomfort that rose in my body and my legs. And I would just kind of sit with it and really try to relax with it. But after a while, I noticed, like on a retreat, I would hear the bell calling us back into the hall. And I noticed there's the sound of the bell. And because I was more concentrated, I could notice there's the sound and there's a moment of fear. Okay, so the sound of the bell, there's the fear of going back and kind of self-torturing myself, basically. As I realized that, I remember that moment. It's like, oh, this isn't the right way. That's where effort and the discernment comes in. I'm trying to apply the technique, but I'm causing suffering to myself. So then I learned, okay, I'm going to just mindfully shift when it got too intense to try to sit still. And then practice became much more easy after that. To do, you know, to sit in a chair at times, you know, this big thing, you know, that only the real meditators sit on the ground and everyone else is, whatever that mind state, to realize, okay, sitting in a chair is perfectly valid. That's what I mean by these assumptions, these ways we kind of get in our own way. As Narayan sometimes talks about, we use the Dharma as a weapon against ourselves. We kind of use it to punish ourselves or to cause harm to ourselves. So learning to see that, to see, okay, what kind of assumption am I making? What am I assuming how I should be, how practice should be? Look at the 100-some people here. How could the practice always look the same for each one of us? Some of you have young children, you know, under a year. Some of you have children about to go to college. Some of you have never had children. Some of you have spouses, partners. Some of you don't. Some of you have all these different life experiences. Some people are in their 20s, in their 30s, their 40s, their 50s, the 60s, 70s, and 80s. All these conditions we have to learn to be wise with, to bring that wise energy around. So I said there's three reasons. The next one, so this was the struggle, the difficulty. So sometimes the difficulty is part of the practice. That's the willingness to work with it. That's the energy rises to meet that. Sometimes you need the discernment to realize the way I'm going actually needs to be altered, needs to be shifted. And it can be tricky to navigate that. That's why it's helpful to ask questions, to read, and to inquire around that. The next one is disillusionment, why we have trouble having energy for practice. Disillusionment. Sometimes we start off with these high expectations. Oh, I'm going to start to meditate, and my mind's going to be really quiet. I'm not going to have any more thoughts. You know, this is a common thing that people come on a meditation course and think, okay, I'm going to turn off this thinking mind. And it's such an important thing to realize that the mind can keep thinking. It just becomes less. It becomes more and more in the background. And that the more less friction we have with it, actually, the more the mind quiets down on itself. There's a book that Sharon Salzberg wrote called Faith. And when she used to come here every year, she would often talk about that. And there's this kind of bright faith that we often have when we start practice, like this enthusiasm, like everything is, Buddhism is going to fix everything, Dharma is going to fix everything in my life. And there's so much energy and excitement around it. But then after we practice for a while, that faith becomes a little more dull because it's really sustained by that initial newness of things. And then once it starts to dull, we go into this shifting of how we relate. We start to become confirmed faith, the faith that's based on our direct experience instead of based on what we read or heard. It's like it's what we see, we know for ourselves. And actually in our practice, and certainly in my practice, you know, over time, there's these times of enthusiasm and energy. Then there's a time of a kind of disenchantment or disillusion with my practice. And often when I look at that from a deeper perspective, it's those assumptions I talked about that we start with our practice, that often get our energy going. We start to realize, okay, those don't make sense anymore. One of the biggest ones is just this shift of not really believing in this sense of self. You start to see through that more and more. And then the whole reason to get over yourself doesn't make so much sense anymore. Right? It's like if there's not really the self that's here, then that energy starts to fall away. Because there's a lot of energy to try to make a better sense of self, isn't there? Like, I want to be a better me, right? There's nothing wrong with that. But at some point, our practice starts to show us there's a fundamental assumption that's not quite right, a fundamental fallacy we need to investigate. So that causes everything to recalibrate, to reshift. And this is our natural part of practice. It's part of the ups and downs. And that's why, you know, we go through our practice. If you look at, you know, I could take a survey of how many people in the room are like in their first year of practice, first 5 years, 10 years, and there's often kind of drops off, you know, and there's a kind of a place around 5 years or so. We go through this shift of a little bit disillusionment. We're not quite sure. The reason we started to practice don't make as much sense. You know, or maybe we have to recalibrate why we're practicing. Sometimes bringing more energy to it is so helpful. And finally, the last one is distractions, that we have trouble practicing. We don't have the energy to practice. And Buddha said that Dharma practice is like going upstream. It's going against the stream, you know, of the world, of our society. Streams going a certain direction of seeking pleasure, of seeking distraction, seeking entertainment. You talk to your friends who aren't practitioners, you know, they're going to think you're a little strange for sitting quietly. It's like, what, you're going to speak, go on a retreat and you're not going to speak at all? How many people who've gone on retreats, you have people who just look at you like you're crazy? Like, why would you even do that? You know, why would you spend that much time by yourself? So this is this going against that stream, going against the pull of society. And it's really alluring, isn't it? I mean, it's like, you know, you look at Netflix, it's like there's thousands and thousands of movies that sound really interesting sometimes. You know, there's this constant allure, this constant pull. Last week, Arv and myself, we did the yearly remembrance ceremony, and he shared in his talk the five daily reflections, you know, that, you know, this body is of a nature to age, of to get sick, that everything that I hold and to die, everything I hold dear will eventually be taken away from me. That the only possession I really have is my actions or my karma. You start to reflect on that, that brings that energy back. It gives you a sense of perspective with this allure of life. So I think one of the benefits of being lay practitioners is that we can really enjoy life. We can enjoy things in a full way. We can have relationships. We can have intimate partners. We can have all these expressions of being human. And we learn how to bring the Dharma into that. And we can get distracted. We can get kind of pulled off that. And so part of it is sometimes going back to tweaking the practice or reinvigorating it or looking at a different way of practicing, bringing that energy back, bringing that inspiration back. So energy is an essential part of our practice. We won't be able to do anything if we don't have that energy. And sometimes realizing that the lack of energy, it's actually much shallower than we actually take it to be. You talk to many teachers, and I've experienced this too, like after a day of work, it's like, I don't know how I'm going to have the energy to speak or to teach. And somehow you come up and the energy comes forth. Same thing with our sitting practice. You may think, okay, I just can't sit. I'm too tired or too distracted or too restless. Just sit for 5 minutes. Sit for 5 minutes. And if you want to keep sitting, give that as an option. Sometimes it's just that initial thing, getting over that. I think that's, you know, this the research around decreasing the friction around activities is so helpful. Make it easy for yourself to practice. Make it easy, kind of built in. Bring a quality of sangha, you know, of some ways it's accountability, but sometimes it's just that sense of being on the path. Sometimes you have trouble practicing. Find a buddy and say, you know, I want to check in with you each day and say, okay, I practiced today. Or maybe at the end of the week, I practiced for this number of days. And just that little bit of accountability, that little bit of celebration, that brings that extra energy. So energy is an essential part of Dharma practice. Without it, you know, we wouldn't be here. And realize it goes through different phases, different expressions. It intertwines between wise effort and all the other paramis. All right, let's just sit quietly for a couple of moments, letting those words settle. And then we'll have a chance for any questions or sharing. All right, so we have some time. If there's any questions about energy or about any other aspect of the Dharma.
Hi, my name's Claire. So my question involves pursuing a dream, and I'm not talking about the dreams that are extremely hard to achieve, like becoming a professional athlete or singer or something like that, like the normal dreams that most of us have in our professional and personal lives. How do we know, some of the things you said earlier reminded me of this, but how do we know when pursuing a dream is becoming delusional, or if aspects of it are becoming delusional, and when the discomfort we're feeling is just growing pains from the journey and we just need to keep going. Do you have any recommendations on that?
Sure. So kind of the question is around, you know, pursuing a dream, you know, in a profession or some part of your life, when do you know when that's coming from a place of delusion versus a place of wisdom or really heartfelt grief, or, you know, kind of that pulling of the heart. And then also part was like when there's a struggle around it, when you know. So tell me about the struggle piece, because that can show us up whether it's, you know, wise or not. So not if you're going to find the perfect thing, you're never going to have struggle.
So, I mean, my situation probably doesn't apply to anybody else, but for me specifically, there's a dream I'm pursuing, and the questions that are batting back and forth in my head are whether or not to go into academia or in another sector, and whether to move locations to pursue the dream or do it from here, because the path I'm going on has a couple different options. And so I'm trying to discern, like, what is a realistic, I'm working very hard to achieve this goal. And so I'm trying to discern, like, what aspects of it are just me using my imagination too much, and what aspects of it are just difficult because it's a hard journey. I don't know if that makes sense. Sorry if that's like really oddly specific.
Yeah, I think it's a common thing is how do we make decisions? You know, how do we have that, you know, clarity of mind? And it's interesting how Dharma practice, you know, relates to that and how, you know, it divides. Basically, Dharma practice isn't going to tell you, here's a list of things you should do and not do. But it's more like, this is how you can learn to see for yourself. So for myself, what I would, you know, what I like to try to do is kind of try, really be very sensitive to my inner experience as I contemplate those different choices. So noticing, you know, maybe take one day, just say, let's say you have five choices, right? So number one day, you know, you just kind of sit with that one choice. Just imagine that you've taken that choice and notice what comes up for you. You know, noticing what's the internal sensations, what's the emotions, what's the deeper beliefs, particularly noticing if there's a sense of, okay, yeah, there's a sense of grounding and alignment, or there's a sense of, ooh, I don't know if I wanted to do a little bit of regret. You know, one technique I heard is like you take a coin and you flip it and you say, okay, heads, I do that. Tails, I don't. And notice when it flips and you see it, what's your first reaction? Let's say it's affirming it and you're like, oh, good. Or if it's not affirming it, you're like, oh, you know, we kind of get in our own way sometimes thinking so much about it. So basically, yeah, just kind of contemplate it. I wouldn't necessarily put the layer of, you know, is this delusion or not around it? Because part of that is we just have to figure that out for ourselves, you know, over time. Because if everybody had a deep abiding sense of non-self, we wouldn't get a lot done in the world, to be honest. I mean, there wouldn't be a lot of, you know, growth and exploration, and it'd be kind of like, oh, it's all empty. There's like a level of perfection here. I don't really need to change anything. It's like, it's okay. You know, and so it's like that sense of needing to change and grow, that's a positive force in the world too. And to also realize that if we really get invested, like my whole identity is based upon this thing that I'm seeking, just to realize at some point you won't have that identity, right? At some point, that position fades or you can't do it anymore, or you're on your deathbed. And just to realize the more you're invested in it, the more you cling to it, the more suffering there will be. And that's where the wisdom comes in. So it doesn't mean we can't full-heartedly go into something, but realize it's also impermanent.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Yeah, go ahead, Monica.
Yeah, thanks. I'm one of, I know I'm not the only one, of the people who have a lot more trouble practicing at home by myself than here. And I remember asking you about it when I was, not so long ago, when I was a student in the meditation course, and you gave me some tips about how to do it a little bit at a time. And those were helpful, but I would really love to hear your thoughts about kind of, I don't think for me it's just accountability. It literally, there is some energy in the room here that I don't have at home.
Yeah.
But I would love to be able to kind of figure out what that is and maybe reproduce it. because we don't have this every night.
That's right.
So can you come into it a little bit deeply?
Sure. So this sense, just, you know, really drawing strength from being in community, having other people practicing right alongside you. That's very supportive. Does it work for you online at all when you're like, if you're with other people online?
Yes, somewhat. Yeah. This is better. But yeah.
So you kind of, we are working with, you know, conditions, because ideally you would have sits every day in person. And, you know, we have this place, we could potentially start having sits more during the day too. We have a whole new crop of local Dharma leaders that can start to maybe offer more of those kind of opportunities. Because there is something really powerful about sitting in person with each other, because you sense that support. It's like, it's sometimes it's, I remember when I first started to practice, sometimes arrive late and I would come into the hall and just feel like I was entering this very still field. It's like, it's almost like my breathing changed. You know, it was, I could really feel the presence of everyone practicing. And we can feel that online. And there's a number of people who don't live in the Seattle area, and you know, they show up all the time in an event, you know, in sits we do here and other sanghas. So that's one thing you can consider. But what probably the biggest thing I would point to is start your practice by just reflecting on sangha. Do you realize then that literally any time that you sit, there's other people sitting at the exact same time. You know, if you ever use Insight Timer, it tells you like, you know, 20,000 people just sat with you. And just kind of reflect on that. It's like, wow, there's all these people sitting with me right now. So maybe start off the sit that way. And if you start to feel the energy drag, just kind of realize, wow, I can imagine maybe two houses over there's someone sitting right now. You know, maybe there's people sitting right this moment. And that starts to bring that energy in.
Thanks. So I didn't hear that you feel there's some particular virtue at going at it alone, that like we should all learn how to do it in our own, you know.
Well, I mean, I try to meet people, you know, where they are, mm-hmm. you know, so that's, it's, so I wouldn't.
You don't think that's something to strive for? Should I be kind of like figuring out the way instead of...
So is that your question?
Well, no, that's a follow-up, I guess.
I answered the wrong question.
No, thank you.
No, I can answer that question too. Okay, so you know, in terms of like being able to practice without having that support of other people. Yeah, I think ideally that is, you start to be able to practice whether there's people around or not. Because it's kind of like that... you become more and more kind of self-sufficient, kind of really, it's a deeper level of owning the practice, if you will. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like training wheels. You know, it's not quite like that because, you know, there is a power of Sangha, but there is a little bit of that. It helps kind of bolster you. Just like if you go on a retreat, if you're sitting on a retreat, everyone's sitting in the hall all the time doing walking meditation, it's much easier to do it because you realize, okay, everyone else is doing it, I'm going to keep doing it. If you're doing a solo retreat with no one else around, you'd be like, it might be a little harder to find that energy. Personally, for myself, being more of an introvert, I sometimes really like to sit completely by myself. Like I did a month long at Spirit Rock, and I spent a lot of the afternoons sitting out in the woods all by myself. And I really enjoyed that sense of stillness, because there's a way that... there's not that energy coming all around you too. So play with that too. You know, play with that. Okay, how can I find that inner stability? So how do you do that? Going really from the basis of the talk is like looking at that, you know, where really is that, you know, the energy coming from, there's the suffering, but there's the energy that comes really from the awakening, the opening, to start to become more and more attuned to that. Because that really can start to bring that sense of inner stability or inner of independence of practice, because you start to sense that. Okay, that's available whether I'm with a lot of people or completely by myself. That becomes this orienting factor. It's kind of like this self-sustained quality. It's like your own fire is growing by itself.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think that's going to be something meaningful for me. So
good. Thank you, Monica. I look forward to checking back in about that. I'm trying to think that I'm big on that screen right now. Okay, Iris, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. First of all, I just wanted to say congratulations to all of us.
It's thank you.
Absolutely thrilling to see that we're in the space downstairs. So it's so moving and wonderful. And your talk was wonderful, Tim. I don't have a specific question, but I do want to say that the happiness that you radiated throughout your talk and pleasure with being there gave me a lot of energy to continue. So thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, that's one thing I didn't touch on in the talk specifically, but that kind of brightening of the mind is also a great way to bring energy, because you know, sometimes we have such a strong negativity bias, I should say, and you know, there's so much worry in our lives, but to bring that sense of mudita, that sense of energy. Ajahn Jayasara, who was here back in May, he was talking about with practice, when you don't have the energy, his kind of go-to or his secret weapon is mudita, his sympathetic joy. It's to see people succeeding and celebrate in that, bring energy to that. And that's a great way to bring energy into our practice. So, you know, reflecting on gratitude, on reflecting on your own good behavior, or your good ethics, or your own good heart, all these things can bring energy. You know, celebrate other people's. You know, really enjoy this sense of sangha. So yeah, that's, and yeah, thank you for all your work on this. You know, you're very involved in the design component of it. So thank you, Iris. All right, anyone else? Yes, do you mind coming up here? I can just move this so I cover myself up. Is that okay?
Sorry, I missed it.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm shy about my picture being up there. So.
Oh. It's very distracting. I'm Anne, and you mentioned Insight Timer, so, and you also mentioned like picking one type of thing. So I've just discovered Insight Timer like in the last few weeks, month, or, and I'm like on fire. Like I can't wait to do another meditation.
Oh, nice.
Because they're really different. Mm. And so that is my question. Like, cause I, you know, so I'm like, oh, that sounds interesting. Let me do
the guided meditations.
Yeah. So yeah. Just all these different kinds of things. And it doesn't feel like, I mean, it's definitely giving me hours of meditation, but it's not like deepening a particular practice per se. Although they're, you know, obviously yeah. I have favorite teachers, but.
Yeah. So whether, you know, using the guided meditations on Insight Timer or other apps, you know, where does that fit in mm-hmm. to practice and the, you know, the deepening in one area, that kind of thing. And also the last comment or second to last around kind of the independence of practice. So, you know, guided meditations, and personally, I use Insight Timer just for the timer part of it, because I don't usually take guidance. I don't use guidance so much anymore in these days. But at a certain point in my practice, it was really helpful because it gives you kind of clarity of how you should practice. You know, good at guided meditations also has embedded in the attitude and kind of the nuances of how do you direct your attention and some things which are sometimes hard to, you know, to always do on yourself. It really reminds you. It also brings a lot of energy, too. If your mind gets distracted, the voice is going to say, okay, come back to your breath. And it, you know, it keeps you on track. And it's, Tori and I were teaching a retreat at Samish Island back in April. And a number of people were used to having that guidance, you know, that guidance. And when you go on a retreat, we don't give you as much guidance. And so you're like, you're kind of a little bit lost in that. It's kind of like you have to go from having this really strong scaffolding to being unscaffolded, right? So this sometimes is a harder transition. So basically what I would suggest is just notice, you know, try to have some time when you're practicing without the guidance. You know, just to see what, you know, maybe do it every other day, for example, and see what that's like. If you notice that you really are kind of having trouble focusing or getting distracted, realizing, is that because I'm just, you know, I need to kind of build up that capacity, work with the hindrances, to build up my own internal kind of muscle of mindfulness, you know, that kind of thing. Guided meditations also can be really helpful when I'm struggling in some area. Like I'm just having a lot of grief right now, or I'm just really having a lot of anger. You can pull out a guided meditation on that. How do I work with emotions? So you can kind of, you know, pick and choose. But, you know, generally I would say guided meditations have their place, and also, you know, over time we kind of use them less and less. That helps. Yeah.
Thank you.
I guess I would also just add, Anne, that the sense of even though the guided meditation may be in different directions, especially if it's all in kind of the overall umbrella of like insight meditation, it's still deepening things. Yeah, it's still deepening. Some practices are really just focus on this one technique and do that for 20 years or do it intensely for a period of time. That will to lead to some kind of opening or different seeing, right? So there's kind of the two spectrums. All right, anyone else? Yes, do you mind coming up for the mic?
Hi, I'm Leslie. I was thinking to what Monica was saying, because, I mean, I feel like I've fallen completely off the bandwagon. It's been a long time since I've been here. I really have very little practice at home, and I'm trying to find a way to get back into it. And when you're speaking of energy, I too have a hard time just at home feeling like I want to make that time or having the energy for it. And so I've been thinking about like trying to do something like when somebody suggested, well, when you're first waking up in the morning, it can be like a, you know, instead of just going back to sleep, you just kind of get up and kind of an easy way to get into it. But I was thinking about your talk about energy, and one of the things that gives me energy pretty instantaneously is being outside. And so I think that that's something, it's just kind of occurred to me when you were talking to Monica, just it's like, well, maybe I just need to change my location. And especially with the weather being so nice and the mornings being so nice and you've got the birds starting so early, maybe that's what can help bring me energy and bring that desire to be there. And even if it's not necessarily like, I mean, I feel so early in the stages that it's kind of more of a mindfulness meditation where you're listening to the birds, you're just being present. And that might be a start to get back into a practice at home. So it was just kind of more, I don't have a question. Mm-hmm. It's just more me rambling. But no, just more like what kind of came out of that. Listening to you guys talk about that and that's just great, what the energy is bringing up.
And that's a factor of discernment too, is like realizing, okay, maybe the nature, you know, being out in nature helps something, you know, there's more activity, there's the birds, there's a way that we kind of relax into nature. Mm-hmm. You know, I love to sit outside. That's my favorite thing is to go out into my backyard, and I have a tarp set up so I can sit. I mean, in wintertime, I'm all bundled up. Because it's really a nice thing for me to sit out in nature that way. Yeah. You know, hear sounds, but there's also the way the stillness starts to also teach too. You know, I think Ajahn Chah would often, Westerners would come to sit with him, and he would just have them go sit in the woods for a while, realizing that the woods themselves would be a teacher.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I endorse that. I think that's a great idea.
Thanks.
All right, Liv, go ahead. Or Liz, sorry.
Hi, thank you. So I just finished my first retreat, like insight retreat, on Friday, was it? And last Wednesday. And I left feeling this beautiful energy, you know, and I can feel myself wanting to cling to it so much. And I can feel it like kind of dissipating. And then I'm like, oh, I haven't even gone to work yet. Oh, boy. So I'm like, how do I continue on with bringing that same energy forth as I go into, especially at my work, a challenging, kind of fast paced, hard environment? Maybe I'm hoping for too much to continue on the space that you create during retreat, but to bring a part of that with me also somewhat.
Yeah, thank you, Liz. That's a very common experience. And congratulations on your first retreat, too. You know, the retreat, you know, thinking about the retreat format, I teach about 5 retreats a year. And it's a very common thing that happens is that the retreat itself is a really kind of rarefied structure, right? You don't have your job responsibilities. You know, you're not on your phone. You just have like maybe one yogi job to do. But the rest of the time, you're just being still with yourself. And you're really encouraged to be quiet, and you have everyone else practicing around you. And you don't have that those same conditions when you go off into work and relationships and back into, you know, speaking and all that stuff. But what does transfer is kind of the learning, you know, is that learning. So the more we kind of hold to that, the state that the form engenders, that's going to be harder to do. That's going to cause some suffering around that. But try to go to, you know, I know there's a longing for that, but think about what did that stillness teach you? It's like the stillness is the stillness in itself. It's just another, it helps you see something about who you are and what you are in the world. And so start to, you know, maybe that sense of connection. Okay. Maybe I have all these distractions, but maybe I can still connect with something in my body right now. You're doing walking meditation, you can be 100% in your body. Sitting meditation, 100% in the body. What if you just said, okay, I'm going to be like 10 or 20% in my body, and that's really good for daily life. That's actually huge. Most people like, how are your feet feeling? Like, what? I have feet? You know, we don't even connect with that. But if you just were able to feel your feet while you're doing all your busyness of your work and your responsibilities, that's going to transform how you are in that. Yeah, and there's also, you know, the assumptions about who you are. All those things start to, that's why life is so important to integrate our practice in our lives. Yeah. So thank you. Very important question. Okay, so let's do Mariah.
Hi, good evening. Nice to see everybody. I was also on retreat. I believe the same retreat Liz was on. Yeah. And, my question is that, moved energy through, the heart, so through opening, a very, big energy that had been there for many years. And so, my question is, I'm trying to understand that, I'm still getting used to like seeing things anew. And then, there's a sensation of emptiness, but not like, it's like a good emptiness because it's the suffering is gone. So right. I'm just trying to understand more, and I signed up for some courses to dive deep into Dharma. And so I'm trying to understand how energy relates to emptiness, and I'm not sure if I'm correlating those correctly.
Okay, how energy relates to emptiness. And it's also part of your question is around kind of the integration of that big opening of the heart into life.
Yeah, yeah. It's been really wonderful.
Yeah. Well, energy and emptiness, it's interesting. It's almost like that. I can't do like a definitive statement like this is what it is because it's really an alive relationship. Because sometimes that contact with the emptiness, that's where it fuels energy into the rest of our practice. And that's actually, I'll go back to the integration with that point in a second. Also, the very quality of being in the midst of emptiness, especially that emptiness of that suffering or that dukkha or that self-identification, that in itself, there's just this different quality of energy that's really been transformed by that. Because it's like it's not me who's doing something. Okay, that's kind of one of the fundamental pieces is that I'm not doing it. It's more like something else is flowing. Yet things are being done. Yet there's still energy to do and to engage and to practice and be present. So it's kind of that freeing up of that contraction around sense of self, of identification, of that limitation, of clinging, all those different ways of seeing the same thing, that's freed up. Now, when you start to have like a deep opening, like I think you're talking about, you know, especially with the heart, a lot of the work then becomes it's like this you have this really clear taste of what that's like, clear taste of that absence of that contraction, that quality of emptiness, which is yet really full and interconnected, right? So maybe not for you, but often what happens is that it kind of contracts back up a little bit. Right, you have the right circumstances, the right input, and it kind of contracts. Now that's such an interesting moment of practice because we can say, "Oh, I've failed. I'm not doing this well anymore. I'm off the bandwagon, whatever it might be. Or you could look at it as, oh, isn't it interesting how there's this contraction now? Because you have this reference of what it's like for the heart to be really open. Right? So then you say, okay, there's this contraction. So I know the contraction isn't all of me. I know there's also the capacity for openness too. And so you start to get to notice, okay, what's the assumption? What's the perspective that comes forth to create that quality of closedness? So you actually turn toward it actually as a gift, like, oh, let me see what it's like. Why? That's interesting. I reacted to that question or that individual or that situation in that way. And it kind of reminds you, you start to realize, okay, there is emptiness still in there. There's still that openness of heart. Does that help you? Or does that meet the question kind of, or not quite?
No, it does. This is probably the second time from retreat where something is known and it has not, changed. And so it's constant since then. I do notice like some, sometimes contractions, but it's the opening is so over. It just notices it and then it goes away. So it's gone. So, it's never been so known. So it's very interesting. Yeah. So I'm going to dive deeper into it, but, just want to, that is very helpful. Thank you very much, Tim.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially when there's that sustained quality of it, it's like the effort and energy become more of just surrendering into that. Like, let me relax even more deeply into that. All right. Thank you, Mariah. Good to see you. All right. Well, thank you for celebrating this first day of this new center. So delightful to see everyone, and both here in person and also online. All right. Have a good rest of your day, evening, wonderful week, and hope to see you again soon.